Insurgent.
Going to call the House Committee on Judiciary to order Thursday, November 17th. And we're going to have an informational hearing first on the sex offender registration work group. Mr. Taylor, do you have any information you need to tell us ahead of time?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we had an excellent presentation before the Senate yesterday with a very capable group. Jeff Wood did an excellent job. If you remember, this issue came to us as a result of a Senate bill last session that you and Representative Barkas wanted to take a look at the issue as it relates to sex offender registration and expunction because of the wide net that we cast on both those.
Okay. I appreciate the work group. We'll call them up here in a minute. Also, Co-Chair Barker, Representative Garrett, and Schaffer are going to be missing today. In their place, though, we have Representative Tomei is going to take the gavel about halfway through. And we'll get to she'll have the privilege of the most prestigious gavel in the building.
Ooh.
For the first time.
Ooh.
So. Jeff Wood, you can bring up ever who you want with you. You got a pretty big list there.
Mr. Chair, I think Bai is just trying to pretend there with that. I don't.
Is that what it is?
You know, last special session, I was in a walker because I messed up my left knee. This time, I messed up my right knee.
Wow.
Getting time to retire.
Oh. You know how many people would lynch me if I did that?
Well, please identify yourselves, and everyone who wants to start can do that.
Chair Krieger, Vice Chair Hicks, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Wood. I serve as the Parole and Probation Division Commander with the Marion County Sheriff's Office. And with me is Vi Beatty, the manager of the State Police Sex Offender Registry. And we are here, as Legislative Council had mentioned, to kind of bring the committee up to date in terms of some of our progress or meeting progress in terms of sex offender notification and registration laws. Just to kind of give a historical context, we had started meeting during the summer months to talk about, as I said, registration notification, and really kind of looking at some of the existing laws and statutes and current research in terms of, is there a better way that we could do business pertaining to this population? In terms of some of the work group and people who assisted with this presentation, I feel like I need to mention, of course, I've already referenced Vi Beatty. There were several other people who had been involved in this project, so to speak, including Officer Bridget Sicken with the Portland Police Bureau, and she is the Sex Offender Registration Coordinator. Katie Gotch, who is the Clinical Coordinator for the Multnomah County Department of Community Justice. Darcy Baker with the Oregon Department of Corrections and former Vice Chair of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. Brenda Carney, who is with us today. She is the lead parole and probation officer with Columbia County Community Corrections. And my sheriff, Jason Myers, who, and in addition to being supportive of some of these concepts that I'm going to bring forward, obviously is going to also be keeping a very watchful eye on his division commander to make sure he doesn't embarrass the office, so to speak. In terms of some quick history in terms of sex offender registration and notification, in terms of where some of the direction that we are going, I think it's always important to point out where we are and where we've been, quite frankly. In terms of registration by DOC, that began in 1989, and then 1991, the state police took over registration and became a lifetime obligation. In 1999, Oregon adopted Megan's Law in terms of, in reference to Megan Kinka, who in, I believe it was 1994, was killed by a sex offender who moved into her community. This happened in New Jersey shortly thereafter. That's where some of the disclosure community notification for sex offenders moving into neighborhoods began. Thus began the first or initial state police public website. From what Vias told me, 24 short hours later, it was offline due to several court injunctions, and then resurfaced in 2005 with the current public predatory website. In terms of some of the registration facts, pertaining to adults, and I probably should preface this by saying everything I'm going to be talking about today really is specific to the adult side of the population. In terms of registration of sex offenders in Oregon, we're looking at about 12,000 adults who are required by statute to register as sex offenders. 17,000, forgive me, 12,000 of those are people who do not have community supervision, but about 5,000 of those people are on community supervision. We do have a small scattering of people who, non-Oregon residents that come into the state for work or school, but as a subset of that 17,000 people who are required to register by the state, we have about 1,800 Oregon residents who are deemed predatory, and that designation I'll get into in a moment. I think one worthy note to point out is, in addition to those 17,000 souls that are required to register, the state police has to maintain an additional 4,700 out-of-state records to their database. And if you look at it over time, you're basically looking at about 130 people who are added to the registry a month. Going back to that predatory piece, that subset of the total registration population, that predatory, about 10% of that population is deemed predatory. I'm certainly not going to go into the long list of crimes, but just suffice to say there are a number of different sex crimes that requires people to register as a sex offender. And I believe in January 1st, 2012, animal sexual assault will be added to this list of required registrant crimes. Getting to that predatory designation that I spoke about earlier, in 1993, House Bill 2759 allowed for community notification of, quote, predatory sex offenders. If you look at it by statute, basically it describes people who are, quote, currently displaying characteristics to injure or victimize others, and they must have been convicted of one of the following offenses. That's a rape, sodomy, sex abuse, or unlawful sexual penetration in any degree. And part of it, in subset two, it requires that in this process of determining who the predatory sex offender could be designated as, it requires that an agency will use a sex offender risk assessment scale approved by the Department of Corrections or a community corrections agency. Over the years, we've gone through about four or five, manifestations of various assessment tools that we've used to designate people as predatory. The first one, or I should say the first two, from 1993 to 2003 was our sex offender risk assessment, and then later the Oregon sex offender risk assessment. Basically, that scale in and of itself was sort of, it had some positives and minus scores. There was a positive ranking and a negative ranking, where when you get the sum total, you will get an overall score which would determine the level of supervision. But in terms of that predatory designation, if somebody scored a minus 50 or greater, they could be eligible for the predatory designation, or if they had three asterisk items or an automatic override. Some of those asterisk items include, you know, a history of sex crime convictions, use of weapons during the commission of their sexual assault, or prior non-sexual criminal history. The automatic override would include factors of a forcible rape, men who used a weapon during the commission of their crime, or men who molest boys, which has been shown to be a very high criminogenic factor in terms of future recidivism. With that process in place, these people who would be released from the community from incarceration would just be designated based on this risk assessment tool. Then in 1998, Noble versus Board of Parole basically said the parole board just can't designate this population. They actually have to notify the offender, and the offender actually has had the right to some process to appeal that decision, so to speak, or at least provide information to the Board of Parole contesting that their designation, so to speak. Then in 2003, due to some factors that really sort of came out of the blue for us, We learned that the sex offender risk assessment, the SORA, the OSORA, actually could not be validated, or we couldn't find any statistical validity to those tools that we were using. We were sort of at a crux, if you will, in terms of what our next steps would be, and then we decided, you know, whether or not to create a new risk assessment tool or get one off the shelf, so to speak. And the designated tool, we decided to go see what other jurisdictions are using, and that's where we came across the Static 99, which was developed in Canada. And that Static 99 tool is a tool that is designed to predict future sexual or violent reoffense for those qualifying sex offenders. Initially, the predatory score, the predatory scale that we used, was a score of 4 or greater. And that was a score of 4 out of 10 possible questions. And so those offenders would be designated as predatory. But then in 2005, we had the VLY versus the Board of Parole ruling, which basically said not only for people who qualify in terms of they have a qualifying conviction of rape, sodomy, sex abuse, or unlawful sexual penetration, not only do they have to have those characteristics shown to injure or victimize others, but they have to be currently demonstrating those characteristics to injure or victimize others, which the parole board in response had to do a psychological evaluation pre-release to determine if somebody would be designated as predatory. I think in a very shrewd move, the parole board decided to bump up the score, so to speak, so that somebody, you know, who previously would get a 4 and be designated, they bumped it up to a 6, which really sort of streamlined that highest risk population in terms of it being more likely than not that they would commit a sexual or violent reoffense, and so they adjusted that score accordingly. In terms of some of the public information that can be released, you know, there is a differential criteria, so to speak. You have predatory versus non-predatory. You have registration information that can be released versus notification information. Sometimes there's a difference between people, what you can be released when people are supervised but not supervised. And so sort of in terms of some of our experience, we've seen that this population in and of itself is, you almost apply all as the same approach where, you know, human behavior being what it is, we tend to assume the worst in terms of this population. Again, you know, I realize, you know, sex offenders aren't exactly everyone's favorite topic to talk about and can provide a very emotional, if not visceral, response sometimes. And so accordingly, a lot of times people presume the worst about this population, where with some of the scoring systems that we had used in the past, you really are mixing some very different populations within this sex offender population. And honestly, I think in 17 years in this business, it can be confusing both to the public and those professionals, so to speak. I find myself calling Vi quite often, asking about some clarification, which she always corrects me. But again, for the public, that can be a little bit confusing. In terms of some of the purposes for registration and notification, you know, we were sort of the assumption that, you know, we do wish to enhance public safety. We want to provide information that is both relevant and necessary to enhance said community safety. And then we want to prevent crime by, you know, letting the residents know information is power, so to speak, you know, when sex offenders move into their community. And it's also, in and of itself, we found, you know, within the Marion County Sheriff's Office, it's provided an opportunity to sort of educate the public about registration and notification, really facts about sex offenders in and of themselves. We have a team in Marion County that coordinates with the Salem-Keizer School District, Salem Police Department, and our own enforcement division, the Sheriff's Office, to meet with school-aged children, their parents, to educate them and sort of provide the facts about sex offenders, what we've seen over time, and really some things that may not be true about this population. Now I'm getting on to some of our legislative concepts that we're looking for during the 2013-2015 legislative session. And I kind of want to say this, that we're obviously not looking for anything to move forward during February, but really for the next legislative session, because when you get into sex offender registration, notification, you're talking about a variety of different laws that we need to look at. But one of the things that we're sort of evaluating right now is based on some of the current research and national trends regarding registration notification. You know, we're looking to replace our predatory, non-predatory system by a tiered level level system. We think this is, you know, one, a little more simplistic, and two, more easily understood, where a level one would be a low-risk sex offender, a level two would be a moderate-risk sex offender, and then a level three, for lack of a better word, could be that predatory sex offender that we have a current RS language for right now. In terms of why some of these changes are needed, I guess I should say, in terms of a tiered system, we're not looking at just that rape, sodomy, sex abuse, unlawful sexual penetration to potentially qualify for that notification, that level three sex offender. We're really looking at opening it up to all sex offenses, that big long list that I gave you in the first couple of slides. Because, you know, with just being convicted of one of those four offenses doesn't necessarily mean that those are the only offenses where it could potentially pose a risk to the community or a high risk to recidivate. And so then we kind of get away from that predatory, non-predatory designation, kind of the public version of what they, you know, define predatory versus the ORS language. And then also this would help us to eliminate the overestimate of statutory offenders, which I'll get into in a minute, and it would take away that all is the same category for this population, where we could differentiate on a very simplistic scale which population is more serious than the other, is more serious than the other. Getting into that overestimate of statutory offenders, you know, one thing that in the evolution of our sex offender risk assessments, what I was talking about earlier, and I should preface this by saying I don't condone the behavior. I'm just trying to explain it a little bit. With our current risk assessment system, or what we had done in the past, if you had a 19-year-old who you know, engaged in a sexual encounter with a 16-year-old or a 15-year-old, probably more likely a 15-year-old, and the person, say, was, this occurred at a party. Person was related to the other, to the victim, and just due exclusively to the victim's inability to consent due solely to age, you could have scored that 4 or greater on the static 99, which would have deemed them, quote, predatory, or trigger that predatory status and potential notifications. We do have a fair amount of that population that's in this pool today. If we go to a tiered level system, we believe that that could eliminate that. And again, based on some of the research and evidence that we've been reviewing over time, this really does complement Senate Bill 267. And again, I'm sure you all are very well aware of this. Senate Bill 267 came from the 2003 legislative session, which basically requires that state agencies implement evidence-based practices for the delivery of some of their sex offender treatment, drug and alcohol treatment, and adult recidivism prevention. Part of the reason I'm bringing this up right now is for anyone who's familiar with the research by Dr. Edward Latessa or Dr. Faye Taxman, they talk about this risk-need-responsivity principles. And when I'm talking about risk, I'm speaking about some of those non-changeable life factors, basically risk to recidivate. And we, through the static 99, we have that tool that actually gives us a good gauge, a statistically validated gauge in terms of how, you know, how likely is somebody to commit a future sexual or violent offense in their future. When I'm talking about need, often that's referred to as criminogenic need in terms of some of those personality characteristics, those antisocial attitudes, values, and beliefs that are inherent in people in terms of some of those things that, that are predictive of future risk and can change over time. And then responsivity is just another way of saying, you know, you can point out what are the unique characteristics of the person in terms of, are they motivated to change? Do they have a learning disability? Or are there some ethnicity issues that we need to be aware about when we're dealing with this population? Currently, we have the tools in place to address that risk-need-responsivity principles that I've talked about. We have the static 99, as I brought up earlier, which again is an actuarial risk tool used for the prediction of sexual and violent recidivism. As of 2010, this was the most widely utilized risk assessment, sexual risk assessment utilized in the world. Late 2007, November-ish of 2007 into 2008, that's when, as a statewide process, we implemented the utilization of the stable and the acute. All three, the static, stable, and acute, are complementary risk tools utilized to assess what I just talked about, you know, risk to recidivate, criminogenic needs and responsivity factors so that we can get a very good gauge of the offender and their risk to commit an offense in the future. In terms of some of our draft concepts that we had come up with, utilizing the static 99, we're processing the possibility, how do you break this down in terms of a tier 1, a tier 2, and a tier 3, and we'd come up with some scores where if you look at the static 99 breakdown, if you utilized a score of minus 3 to 1, which is a low risk to recidivate, you could potentially have that be a level 1 offender. In terms of level 2, you could have that score of 2 to 5, which would be a moderate risk. And then level 3, which is our current scoring practices, if you had a 6 or above, you'd be a tier 3 sex offender. And again, that could determine the level of, that tiered level. With those criminogenic needs and responsivity factors, we have a concept that we're talking about in terms of you have the initial static score, but you could use those stable and acute scoring too to either be aggravating or mitigating factors on whether they might go up or they might go down in terms of that tiered level. Some of the reasons that somebody potentially could go up, say from a level 2 to a level 3, would be if they had a deviant sexual preference, they emotionally identified with children, or they had a high level of psychopathic traits. We utilize a psychological evaluation called the PCLR, the Psychopathy Checklist Revised, which can determine whether or not somebody has a high likelihood of having those psychopathic characteristics. And then in reference to some of those responsivity factors, we do occasionally get people that come in and say, I don't care what you say, I don't care what you're going to do, I don't see what I did as wrong. And for those people, that really does speak volumes and could be an aggravating factor to potentially move them up. Likewise, there could be some factors that we're looking at towards a downward departure in terms of even though they may initially score higher on that static 99, they could potentially go down a level based on some mitigating factors, which could include, a debilitating illness or permanent incapacitation, or if they were 10 plus years, say, offense-free in the community. Those could be factors that we would consider. And again, I kind of want to reiterate, these things are in very draft concept right now. And again, once we continue our work, assuming we continue our work on this, we'll be fine-tuning that for the future. Just to use, and I'd like to thank my friends at DOC Research for doing this, if you broke down this tiered level system with, say, Marion County offenders that we're supervising right now and did it on the, broke it down by level, by the scoring that I just described, for level one, you'd be looking at about 24% of our total population that would be a level one. That would be a low-risk sex offender. In terms of level two, you're looking at the bulk of the population, 70%, 338 out of 488. And then for level three, those people that scored a 6-plus on the static 99, 29, about 6% of our total population, which the way that breaks down now with predatory and our total registrant population, you're going from about, say, 10% down to 6. And with the variation in scoring, again, this is a little bit anecdotal, you're probably filtering away those statutory offenders with this new tiered level system. Again, some of the draft concepts that we're looking at as it pertains to registration is if, say, somebody is on supervision, convicted of a sex offense, and they score out as a low level, if they successfully complete supervision, and by successfully completing supervision, I mean they were very compliant, they completed their sex offender treatment, they passed their polygraphs, there have been no violations for a specified period of time in the community, that person potentially could just get relief from registration as a low-risk sex offender. In terms of level two, probably be applying our current law in terms of they could potentially file for relief after 10 years post-supervision. And then for level three, it's either be an automatic lifetime qualification or they could be...
Representative Wisda has a question.
Yeah, on this chart, thank you. Last session, we had a bill brought before us about putting more people on the register into the communities. And some of the testimony talked about other states saying after 10 years of if there's been no other incidents that the person comes off. So this is draft, so we don't have the 10 years now, and are you saying level 1, 2, and 3 would be on the sexual sex registration or to the public, or what would be your recommendation?
Representative Winston, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. Again, I want to preface this again by saying this is very draft and not an automatic. In terms of, you know, level three, it would either be a lifetime requirement to register or potentially requesting a reclassification to level two after 10 years. And then for level two, they could petition for relief after 10. And level one, they could, you know, potentially immediately get relief.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, but that was the question we were presented last session, I think the recommendation of this legislative body was that everyone go and be on the registration now. Are you saying that you're looking at...
He's referring to the internet.
So your proposal, your work now is looking at saying level one would not be, and level two after 10 years petition to be off the sexual registration. Is that correct? Or?
In terms of the internet, I think I'll get to that in the next slide.
Thank you.
If that helps.
Thank you.
And maybe I'll just go to the next slide right now, and if there's a follow-up question.
Sorry.
No worries.
Thank you.
In terms of notification, and again, that's in terms of notification, what, you know, we are looking, again, this is a very draft concept. Level one, again, a very low-risk sex offender. That potentially, in terms of notification, would be notifying the law enforcement community and potentially people that the person is living with. Again, maintaining a very low level of notification. For a level two, which again would be a moderate risk, we're talking about some concepts of notifying law enforcement, daycare, schools, and again, you'll see the asterisk at the bottom. If the person is on supervision, anyone else that may be deemed appropriate in terms of that notification level. And then level three could be our current practice of that internet notification, where the person would be posted on the internet, flyers or media release, flyers going out to the community and notifying that immediate community of the sex offender that lives in the neighborhood. And again, that very similar to the concept of our current predatory notifications that we're doing now. And again, part of the rationale for that was that, you know, when you get to a level three, or that person that scores a six or greater on the static 99, just again, I'm not a statistician, so forgive me if I kind of waffle through this, but it is the statistical likelihood of a person committing a new violent or sexual offense is greater than it not occurring. And so it really does, statistically speaking, that is your very highest risk population of sex offenders in the community. So, sir, did I answer your question?
I think so. Thank you.
I have just one. Do you have numbers or a percent of the level two that you're seeing now? Do you have the information about what percentage of those reoffend?
In terms of the breakdown on the static 99, for the level two, you're in about a 30% to 40% range. When you get to that level three, you're at a greater than 50% probability of sexual or violent reoffense.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Mr.
Jeff, thank you. Okay, could you go back to the last slide they had? Okay, there we go. On your level one, you got minus 3 to 1 on the static. What is the recidivism rate on that? What are you thinking?
Representative Olson, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. Again, this is from memory, so please don't hold me totally accountable for this.
No, I'm typing. Don't worry.
I believe the recidivism rate for that low level is less than 20%. And so again, the likelihood it's you. To argue the converse of that, there's an 80% likelihood that they won't commit a new sexual or violent offense again.
Okay, follow up. Okay, let me see if I get this right. Level one offenders would still be required to register for their life. Was there any discussion at all, depending on what the offense was, and then receiving that type of rating or score, maybe backing off a little bit for the entire life for registering?
In terms of that, Representative Olson, Chair Krueger, members of the committee, in terms of some of those, again, I know I keep saying this, these are very draft ideas that we're talking about right now and some of the details that we'd be working on in the future, but you know, for that low-risk offender, what we're talking about in terms of a level one registration requirement is if, you know, they're convicted, either incarcerated or placed on community supervision, for that period of supervision, they would be required to register. If they successfully completed supervision, then they could either, through an affirmative action on behalf or possibly automatic, be relieved of that registration requirement.
Thank you.
How does age factor into that level one? In other words, it would seem first-time offenders that are 12 to 16, 17, for some of them, it would seem that that number of recidivism there would be lower than a higher age class.
Yeah, Chair Krueger, members of the committee. In terms of age and how we utilize the static 99, age is actually a risk factor, where if somebody's youth can be a risk factor that would score, I guess, against the individual depending on their age. If you look at the static 99 and the scoring components, you basically score a point, so to speak, if you're younger than 25 years. And the reason for that is just the statistical validity of the tool in and of itself, where the younger you are when you commit the offense, potentially the greater risk you could be to the community. Sir, in terms of your question, yes, that is part of the reason, though, too, where we have a fair amount of statutory offenders who are currently deemed predatory because of some of those factors you just mentioned in terms of their age. And again, a decision. Again, I don't condone the decision or the action, but if somebody is young, makes an immature decision, and depending on the age of the victim and their inability to consent due to age, that is where we're trying to filter out that population from the high-risk population that currently is there.
Okay, Representative Wong, do you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to follow up on that because I recall distinctly during the session in a committee hearing, learning and getting the understanding or the impression that youthful offenders under the age of 18 tend to have a lower recidivism rate and respond better to treatment because they are young enough that their behavior and attitudes can change more easily than someone who's older. How does that mesh with the explanation that you just gave to us?
Representative Juan, Chair Krueger, members of the committee. What you heard, yes, you know, in terms of some of the recidivism rates for youthful offenders, you know, they can be more amenable to community placement and treatment and those recidivism rates. And when what I just explained, I don't want to make it sound that age in and of itself is the factor in terms of risk to recidivate, but I would be remiss to say too that it could, that it is not a factor in terms of getting the big picture on the individual to ascertain the probability of recidivism in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Technical question. When we discuss petitioning for relief, are we contemplating the court, the parole board, who? Or do we have even that fleshed out yet? OSP?
Yeah. Good, Chair Hicks. Chair Krueger, members of the committee, that we have yet to hash that out. As you'll see in probably my end slide, the devil is always in the details, and those are topics that we will certainly get to in the future.
Okay.
Okay.
So in terms of, and again, here we are, the devil is in the details, so to speak. You know, is this a perfect concept in and of itself? No. But given the current research, some of the statistical trends, and what we've learned in terms of our own evidence-based practices implementation, in terms of public policy, we feel that this does give the best bang for the buck. Knowing that the state is in the middle of a great recession, you know, our intent is to genuinely work with existing law. There are laws on the books that, you know, possibly, you know, that would help us in towards this endeavor, or at least have very little, if any, cost impact, knowing that we can't come forward with a very, you know, expensive package for some of these reforms. I'll be blunt. I mean, the one issue that is a conversation stopper in some of our meetings is the retroactivity piece. You know, what do we do for the population that may, you know, is deemed predatory, yet wouldn't be deemed predatory with this new tiered system? What do we do about that? And again, those are those conversations that we'll be having in the future. And then, you know, really one of the last things I kind of want to bring up is, with, you know, offender typology, what I mean by that, besides possibly creating a new word to sound intelligent, is that in terms of people, you know, we, you know, per RS, you know, we have various levels of crimes and people who can be convicted of said crimes. Yeah, when you look at risk or risk to recidivate, the crime in and of itself isn't, it can be a health predictor, but it is not the sole predictor for future criminal or sexual behavior in terms of being reconvicted of a sexual offense. And so when I kind of did that breakdown of high, medium, and low sex offenders, you can have people who were convicted of a sex abuse one who scored very, very low in terms of the future likelihood of them committing a future sexual offense. Now, on the flip side, you can have people that have potentially been convicted of rape three who could be very, very high. And so some of that, I guess, you know, what people think is kind of, you know, just common knowledge really almost is counterintuitive in terms of that doesn't make sense. But again, when you go into the risk assessments and you see truly it's not so much the crime that they've committed, but really who they are as individuals that we're looking at in terms of this future tiered system. And again, I'll reiterate this, as we work towards this in the future, the devil will truly be in the details. That said, you know, in a very conceptual context, there is a broad range of support for this concept, so to speak. We do have support, conceptually speaking, from the Oregon Association of Corrections Directors, the Sex Offender Supervision Network, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers, and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. And again, although I didn't get to it in time, the Oregon District Attorneys Association, too, has been is supportive of this concept in terms of where we are right now. And that is a lot of information in a short amount of time, but the sum total of my testimony, and obviously I'm available for any further questions.
Representative Hicks has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Indeed, devil's in the details, but something such as this details can be threshold questions. The reciprocity statutes that you've handed out here, I think, came from you, right? These statutes, I don't know... I have a copy of it. I don't know if everybody does. It's the state reciprocity statutes.
Oh, there they are.
What type of reciprocity?
Is this for sex offenders or a function?
That might be the qualified
person. Yeah.
Okay. So, in any event, what I want to say is, how would we, for the group to contemplate, how would we handle persons moving to Oregon from out of state who are required to register in their state? As in, if they find our registration system more agreeable than theirs, I don't want to become a big magnet for sex offenders from around the nation to come to Oregon. So is the group contemplating that?
For the record, Vi Beatty, manager of the Sex Offender Registry for the State of Oregon with Oregon State Police, Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Hicks, members of the committee. Currently, what happens in Oregon for persons moving into the State of Oregon who have the equivalent of a rape, sodomy, unlawful sexual penetration, or a sexual abuse, any degree, any attempt, we at Oregon State Police in the registry conduct a static 99 on them to determine are they predatory or not. Because of the detail work that's required, it may take us 6 to 8 months to get the information in order to do that. Because we're after police reports, we're after psychological evaluations if they were conducted in another state. We're also after pre-sentence investigations. We're trying to find any juvenile crimes. I mean, we're looking for a mass of information that Department of Corrections usually has on hand for Oregon convictions, but resides elsewhere in other states, which we may or may not be able to obtain. The same process would be completed through a tiered system. It's just we would go from the persons with the four equivalent crimes to
the entire number of persons moving into the state. For persons moving into the state under compact, that would fall squarely on the shoulders of community corrections as it does now.
Okay. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I noticed the people that you've listed under the support. Have you contacted at all any treatment providers to have gotten feedback from them about your proposals?
Representative Tomei, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. When I mentioned the Sex Offender Supervision Network as a supportive body of this concept, the Sex Offender Supervision Network is basically a body of practitioners, so to speak, parole and probation officers, law enforcement, and treatment professionals, and that this concept has been presented to them in terms of the tiered level, again, in a very, the generalities, the concept design that we're in right now. And so, yes, in that regard, they've been consulted and are so far have been supportive. We haven't, there is the Oregon Association for the Treatment of Sexual Abusers, and the president, I believe, is also a member of the Sex Offender Supervision Network, and he is supportive of the concept.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm interested to know, after a couple of decades, what studies have been done that help us understand whether or not the Sex Offender Registry is accomplishing the public policy goals that we want it to accomplish. Is there some way that you guys can gather that information and provide it to us offline? Because, I mean, your presentation is excellent, and it makes logical sense, and I think it makes public policy sense. But the problem is I don't know whether it makes public policy sense until I know what public policy goals we're trying to accomplish, whether the existing system is failing in some regard, and if so, why it's failing, so that we know whether this is the right solution. So if you would do that and get it to my office, I'd very much appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Nguyen, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, if this is agreeable to you, there is research into this area, and if agreeable to you, I can get it to the Legislative Council to route appropriately.
Thank you.
You had mentioned on your last slide one of the things was the cost of a new program. I want you to think about, and I'm going to ask Gail Myers to keep everybody reminded of it, there's a certain stigma that goes with this, and it's mostly young men, and therefore opportunity and education, jobs and housing changes. And when that changes, that drives them back towards recidivism and crimes, what they try and try and try, and they can't get out from underneath this thing. So we need to try to evaluate in some way, what does that cost? Anything further?
I have a question.
Jeff, my assumption is if someone were to have their record set aside, expunged, and if, say, for example, it were a sex offense, for example, it was a middle-aged person who has 18 years old was involved in prostitution, or a middle-aged person who at the age of 19 had a 15-year-old girlfriend. And if that conviction were set aside, my assumption is that they would come off the sex offender registration list because they would no longer have a conviction.
Right.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Good question. Now, do you have anyone else that's going to testify that was on the list today, or are you kind of testifying for everybody?
No, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, I've, for purposes of this presentation, I have been the talking head.
I was really hoping we could get Jason up here and give him a bad time, maybe some from the state police.
You'll have other issues to get a bad time.
Yeah? Okay, then. Thank you for your time.
Yeah. Good job.
Yep, good job. And we appreciate the work that's gone into this, but both Representative Bark and I talk about that word called justice, and sometimes we lose that, and we've got to keep that in mind in this committee and as legislators. And I think I paid more attention to it now than when I wore that blue uniform, because I was too busy doing the enforcement. But justice is important. Do you want to go into the next?
Sure, I'll take that one.
Okay, we're going to talk about work group on expunction. Mr. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the work group on expunction has had three meetings. Its next meeting was on December 5th. At the last meeting, Representative Olson was gracious enough to buy pizza for the work group. What we did is we started off with a relatively large group, including both adults and juveniles, And sometimes you have to narrow the group so that you can more readily focus on the issues. And we narrowed it to the district attorneys and the defense bar, myself and Josh Naspi and Representative Olson. And what we have is actually the district attorneys and the defense bar that came to us about the set-aside or expunction law, which is in 137.225. Law was enacted in 1973. It's been amended 20 times piecemeal. And unless you practice all the time in this area, you don't understand the law, okay? Basically speaking, for a lot of offenses, you have to wait for 3 years, and then you can have your conviction set aside. But there are a lot of offenses that can't be set aside. Those are the ones that cause the problems. In our discussions, we talked about the person that we've already talked about, the person that was involved in prostitution at one point. In many cases, as we know from our testimony from last session, on trafficking, that oftentimes these persons are trafficked into that. They wind up with a conviction, or several convictions for prostitution. For the 19 to 20-year-old who has an underage girlfriend, and 20 years later, both parties are registered sex offenders and have to continue to register. At the same time, there's another population out there that the district attorney has brought to our attention, and that's the population that's involved in embezzlement. Oftentimes, they're bookkeepers. They can't get their records set aside, and oftentimes, they go back into the bookkeeping business in every sense of the term. So that was another population that we looked at. What we're talking about is basically three categories. One would be the category that would be set aside in the running of time, as a group that we have now. The other would be, as we have now, is a never set aside. You know, the persons that have convicted violent rape, the persons that you've heard about that have had sex with young boys and things like that. And then the other group that we talked about was where you would give the judges greater discretion. And as you can imagine, there's a bit of debate as to what should be in that group and what issues the judges should consider. At one point, Representative Olson, who was at the last meeting, we thought maybe we could have a bill ready for February. I know both the defense bar and the DAs would prefer, at least at this stage, the 2013 session, as much so they can build consensus for anything that we have among their constituencies. But who knows? December 5th may come, we may strike gold, and you may see a bill coming our way on this. But you definitely will see something in the 2013.
Do we need to have these two go out and testify?
That'll be the next bill.
Okay.
We have Elizabeth Kushaw here and Gail Meyer, if you'd like to hear from anyone how the work group is going.
Do you want to come up and just give us your brief feeling, how you're coming along? Are you working with Representative Olson? Oh, my. We would definitely like to hear from you, probably.
Well, they're very active, Mr. Chair, both of them, and we are hopeful to take a look at some type of a working model the 5th of next month, so and see how that turns out. But the group will get together again and see what we have at that time.
Okay.
Thank you, co-chairs and Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We do want to thank Representative Andy Olson for refereeing at our several meetings. And it actually has been quite collegial. Quite frankly, there's probably more agreement than there is disagreement on this. Everyone agrees that the statute's been amended so many times. We've called it Frankenstein. The statute now reads like a Frankenstein bill. We all agree it needs to be de-Frankensteined. And we do see ways in which each party, each side here, might be able to capture a population that's important to them. So certain crimes that would be now eligible for expungement that may not be, and conversely with the district attorneys, exempting some crimes from being eligible. And so we've now, quite frankly, pinpointed our two point people, one from each organization. They both practice in the Portland area, and we're sort of suggesting that those two sit down, and if they can't be responsible for some of the real nitty-gritty work of de-Frankensteining the bill. But it does go well, and we appreciate the effort and the encouragement to work on this.
Elizabeth?
Good afternoon, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Kushwa. I'm the executive director of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. And everything Gail said was absolutely correct. We have cursed or blessed representatives from each of our organizations who have worked together in the past very well to actually sit down and rewrite the thing from nose to toes, and then to go forward and look at these three tiers of crimes and perhaps the ways that we can relieve people much more quickly and consider the long-term public safety aspects of expunction are set aside more appropriately for adults. So with that in mind and knowing that this is going to be a detailed process, we're hoping, although we don't want to curse them over the holidays too badly, that we see something, you know, in the next few weeks. But I think, in all honesty, given our organizations and how well we know each other, we're looking at 2013 pretty good.
Okay. I appreciate the work that you're doing. You know, having Representative Olson there gives a, you know, a little levity to the situation.
And pizza.
Did you want to expand on your trip to Curry County on my ATV?
I will say to anyone who hasn't gotten out to Gold Beach and personally visited Representative Krieger and his wife at their ranch, I heartily recommend that you do so, because you'll get an invitation to take a tour on the back of their ATV, and you'll definitely have a good time. So.
All right. Thank you, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have anything else on that, Doug? Okay, we go to the report on House Bill 2792.
Did you have that? Chairman of the committee, right, I would have the two witnesses, Patricia Whitfield and Major Joel Ruhan.
Mm-hmm.
If I could, let me read the particular provision from 2792, Section 7. No later than December 31, 2011, the Department of State Police will submit a report to the Interim Legislative Committee relating to the judiciary that describes the state of Oregon's compliance with the National Instant Criminal Background Check System Improvement Amendments Act of 2007, PL 110-180. The report must include a description of the rate at which the state of Oregon is providing the United States Attorney General records relevant to a determination of whether a person is disqualified from possessing or receiving a firearm under federal or state law.
Okay. Go ahead. Everyone wants to go first.
I will. Good afternoon, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. I'm Patricia Whitfield, Oregon State Police Identification Services Section Director, and hopefully you have before you in hard copy and or electronic copy the report that was just mentioned from the 2011 session. And if it serves, I would like to go through the report and highlight just some of the main key points. And hopefully if there's questions along the way, they might be answered as I go through, but certainly I'm happy to answer those at any time. While I am reporting on behalf of the Oregon State Police, I do want to mention that it definitely is a group effort, multi-agency, and the results of where we are today and where we're going reflect work from the Judicial Department, Department of Human Services, Oregon Health Authority, and the Psychiatric Security Review Board. On the background, the National Instant Check Improvement Amendment Act of 2007, known as the NIAA, was signed into law January 8th of 2008, and that did amend the Brady Handgun Violence Prevention Act, which established the National Instant Check, or NICS, system at the FBI. And that system, or that law, requires that all federally licensed firearm dealers must do a background check through that system. The goals and the objectives of the NIAA were enacted as a result of the Virginia Tech shooting, and it seeks to address the gaps of information that is available or not available to the NICS about prohibiting factors such as mental health adjudications, commitments, and other prohibiting backgrounds. There's a number of circumstances and issues over the years that have caused gaps in those types of records nationwide, and I've outlined in the report some examples of those, primarily antiquated infrastructure systems that have been around for many years and really weren't built for statistics or reporting certain types of things, and that has certainly been a challenge. Non-standardized data that might be entered into those data systems, maybe holes within resources of law enforcement, maybe making arrests or courts reporting dispositions to the repository. And to reconcile those records, make them whole after all these years is very labor-intensive and it's time-consuming. But in the processes that we've been using throughout the project, at every possible step, we're looking for ways that not only we do find the records and make them whole, but find a fix for the future that we won't create future gaps. Going into the guidelines and the requirements of the Act, it provides some incentives for states in order to meet the goals that are set out for record improvement. The first one allows for the states to obtain a waiver beginning this year, 2011, for the National Criminal History Record Improvement NCHIP Fund, where a waiver for those match funds could be requested if a state is at least 90% complete in their records reported. The second incentive authorizes a separate grant program to be administered and allow for state executive and judicial agencies to either establish or upgrade their information systems and automating for the timely submission of criminal records and dispositions. And we know that now as the NARIP grant. The third incentive provides discretionary and mandatory burn grant penalties for noncompliance of record completeness. And I've highlighted those, but in essence, the end of a calendar year 2012, and there is a penalty if your records are less than 50% complete. By the end of year 2017, 4% if less than 70% complete. And then from 2018 and beyond, there's a 5% penalty for 90% completeness. According to Section 102 of the Act, the states are required to report to the U.S. Attorney their record estimates of prohibiting categories, which we'll go into next, from this from the past 20 years through December of 2010. And there have been three sessions of those records estimates, and Oregon has participated in all three of them. And the Oregon State Police and the Judicial Department have been the primary agents for reporting those records. And as we go through the categories, I'll explain how those records work. In fact, the next section on the top of page 3 is those seven categories of those prohibitors as required by the NIAA. And I want to make note that the records estimates that we're looking at are from the end of 2010. And we'll refer to the OJD reported records. Those are the Judicial Department's records in their Oregon Judicial Information Network system, which is a statewide case management system. And the repository records reported by OSP are actually all of the records that are maintained in LEDS, as applicable.
Mr. Chair.
There's a wizard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Whitfield, I'm confused. The mental health records are at the state level, and we're sending that to the national level, and the national level sending it back to us. It's sort of confusing.
Well,
Chair Krieger, Representative Wisnat. The mental health records specifically, which we'll get into that category, but those are maintained by multiple agencies currently within the state. And the House bill that was passed to allow our state to, or actually require our state to report those records to the national level so that they would be available nationwide for background checks. They wouldn't return those back to us necessarily.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you. So we're helping the National Register become current with the data that we have.
Correct.
Okay, so when we're getting a background check, but we're getting it locally, we're going through your office, we're not going directly to the National, is that correct?
Correct.
So why are we going through the state again? The national level is up to date.
Chair Krieger, Representative Wisnat, we do not have those records yet at the national level. And I can cover that as we go through. I can cover that category
no, thank
now.
You. Thank you. Thank
Just
you.
Get to it when you get that far.
Okay. And I won't read through all of them in detail, but I wanted to at least go through the first one to help with the pattern of how it's laid out if that would be beneficial. So the first category is felony convictions, and right below that in the italics is the definition based on the NIAA and the U.S. Attorney requirement for that category. In all the categories, our goal is to be 100% compliant or have those records that qualify be available. Following that are the actual numbers that we provided for the 2010 records estimates. So the Judicial Department reported for felony convictions that they had 598,561 records in that category. OSP, the repository reported 592,406. So we see that as a variance of 6,155 that we would be researching or reconciling, going to find those records and making them whole. And the status at that time was 98.9%. And I did get an update as of October 17th where applicable on the different categories, and OSP was able to reconcile additional records to get us to 99.8% in that category. The next category is active indictments, informations, verified complaints. The estimates provided from the Judicial Department's 31,507 for the state repository, and I've got some notes here to help explain. That particular category, we don't have an ability to track based on that definition, but in essence, those are felonies that are open and they haven't necessarily been disposed of. So we know that we have about 44,087 felony arrests on the CCH file that are pending a disposition. And so while we don't have the actual number based on that definition, we believe that we're in compliance just by the fact that we have that many records that are available. While they aren't disposed of, they would require research if they were a prohibitor, and the NICS check or our check would come across one of those records, and that would require research. But those are part of the records, again, that we seek to find closure to what the actual numbers are. Excuse me. The next category is wants and warrants. You can see the numbers there, and we're reporting that we're at 93.8% compliant. The next category, unlawful drug use. We are reporting that we are at 64.3% compliant at the time that the estimates were made. And as of October 17th, we're at 65.1%. Similar to the other category where we are actually looking for court dispositions, we do have arrests for, based on Oregon law, that drug misdemeanor type crimes are required to be reported, we would have an arrest. So again, it acts as if sort of as a flag, but we are still looking for the missing dispositions for about 103,000 records. The next category 5 is the mental health requirement. We are reporting, and this covers a couple different pages, on page 6 we're reporting that we're at a 9.02%. Under the reported records for the Judicial Department, there's sort of a lengthy explanation there. They have reported 46,461 estimated mental health records in the court system. And as research was done into gathering those records, being able to report them to the NICS, originally the courts thought that they would be able to provide those to us, but recognizing some of them would be very difficult to obtain because of the format that they were in, it turned out that they really weren't able to provide those. So the group looked at the other partners, and it was agreed that within the Department of Human Services, the Oregon Health Authority, and the Psychiatric Security Review Board, that they had most, if not all, of the records that the courts would have, although we couldn't verify that until the courts get to a point where they are able to actually look at those records and make a comparison. So it's believed that that number is inflated or duplicated in some way with the other records that are maintained by the other agencies, and we'll continue to work on rectifying that. But then going on to page 6 again at the top, what we're looking at is the records from the Health Authority and the Department of Human Services are 18,832. Psychiatric Security Review Board is 1,520. And with the records that are on the criminal history file 2019, the target records that we're looking at for Oregon to report to NICS is 22,371 total records. So we have a variance of 20,000 records that we're looking at. Collectively, these records are now ready to be placed into our system so we can report them to the NICS. The fact that they're in varied formats and in different locations, it's taken some time to get them into that format, but holding true to the requirement that it's the minimal data that a match could be made if a firearm check is conducted. So it would be the name, date of birth, the gender, and then the agency that owns that record, one of the partner agencies that contributes it to OSP, there's an identifier there to expedite if there's any questions or challenges once that record is on file.
Mr. Chair, this is an issue. I'm sorry, I wasn't able to read this ahead of time. So I'm very interested in this. So at what point does someone who has a mental illness, is that issue put into anyone's files? Do they have to be adjudicated? Do they have to be part of PSRB? Help us understand that.
Chair Krieger, Representative Tomei, yes, they do have to be adjudicated. And once the process that we're setting up is once they are adjudicated and placed either under the Psychiatric Security Review Board or in under the premise of the Health Authority or Department of Human Services, that those records will come to us real time so that we can send them real time, that they're actually not maybe delayed for having access to that. But currently, we don't maintain those records. We have access at state police to conduct a firearms check, but we don't actually maintain those records. But that is part of the process.
Follow-up? So if someone is civilly committed, would there be a record that would affect their ability to buy a firearm?
Yes.
That would be in the record also.
Correct.
So you're saying someone who has been civilly committed, who is, say, schizophrenic, and either commits themselves or a family member commits them. That also would be in this file, and it would affect their ability to buy a firearm.
According to state and federal statute, yes, there are those types of instances.
Yes. And at this point, you're only able to find that material 9% of the time. Is that correct?
That's, Chair Krieger, Representative Tomei, that's the number of records that are currently available to the NICS. And we are in the process of reviewing our administrative rules, and we intend to have those posted in January and load those records by January 15th. So the 22,371 total target records, those will be available to the NICS nationwide by January 15th.
Mr. Chair, could we have a follow-up on this sometime in the February session? You said you'd have this information mid-January.
More than likely, to talk to Mr. Taylor, you make a note of the fact that we'd probably like to have just an informational hearing on the issue.
And Chairman of the Committee, Mr. Chairman of the Committee, Whitfield, when you're talking civil commitment, you're talking the records of the Circuit Court, am I correct? So this would be an issue of tapping into their computer system, would it not? Because they have a computer system that tracks all cases. So there's an adjudication by a court that a civil commit someone because they're a danger to self or others.
The records that are at the court are not available to us directly. That is one of the pieces that we're working on. But if they are qualified under federal or state law to be prohibited, those are the records that the agencies will be submitting to us through this process that we're setting up. So whether it's the record is at the court or they submit that record and it becomes maintained or owned by the review board, the health authority, or human services. Does that answer the question?
Chairman, as a committee, my assumption is that anyone who's civilly committed, that's a finding of the court, there's a record in the courthouse. Now, my assumption is that they're in the state hospital. The issue of a firearm is hopefully moot. I assume the issue comes up when they are released at some point in the future, released back into the community. So my assumption is that's when it would become relevant.
Can I get back to you on that? Please. Thank you.
Mr. Tomei, did you have anything else?
Well, I want to make sure that we understand this issue. I think it's a very important issue, and it troubles me. And I want to make sure that we follow up on this.
And I'm not certain that the department has got all your ducks lined up, that you really understand maybe what we're asking. And I think when was the statute? It was 18, well, basically a year ago, plus that we got out of session a year ago. Let's try to make a presentation available, maybe some more information in January or February when we're here, about what progress you've made on this. Mr. Hicks, did you have anything further?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, a number of questions. I mean, I too am at this point far from comforted that the agency is on the ball on this particular issue. I mean, I'm looking at 9.2% and comparing that even to the other numbers of the other categories, 99.8%, 65%. And then it says here in the report that there are approximately 18,832 records, the bulk of the 22,000 target records that have been collected and converted into the proper format for reporting. And so why haven't those been uploaded? Could you please elaborate?
Co-Chair, Representative Hicks, I think there was some information that was testified to by the previous director of the Identification Services Division back in April 20th, 2011, testified that they were going to do basically an upload of the records. But that was only to bring the records over for the processing that Ms. Whitfield talked about. The testimony on that date also reflected that the records would be available through the for the NICS system towards the end of this year and or the beginning of January of this next year, and we're still on target as we've testified with regard to when we're going to make those records available.
Thanks. When did OSP get the records? Was it around that time, shortly after the April 20th period, or how long have you had these records?
Co-chair Representative Hicks, the information dump that was testified to didn't occur, and we should have been responsive and testify or forwarded that information to y'all. However, even though that did not occur, we're, as I testified a minute ago, we're still on track to provide that information through the NICS system or through the NICS system by January 15th of this year or this next year.
Representative Juan.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So are we at risk of losing any federal funds as a result of the delay that we've been experiencing in completing this effort?
Co-Chair Krieger, Representative Juan. Right now, the estimate is that because we're going to be and we will, Ms. Whitfield will testify to the overall summary of the of our ability to be at better than 90%. But because we're not going to meet that standard, we're looking at a revenue loss of approximately $30,000.
Follow up, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you. My office had sent a letter to you guys inquiring about some of this back before the session was over, and I hadn't heard anything back. So in the future, if you guys would help keep in contact with me in response to my letters, that would help me out a lot so that I can be better prepared when we come into these types of meetings. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Representative Hicks, you have another one?
Yeah, I guess one more. Okay. Yeah, and I haven't seen this term. What is the prohibited persons file?
Co-Chair Hicks and Chair Krieger, that is the process that we're going to putting in place, that the records that are submitted by the agencies per statute, and statute requires that state police obtain those and access them and maintain them and transmit them to the NICS. So that's the term of the file that we are referring to place those minimal data records from multiple agencies to be able to send to the NICS.
Your follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is last. Returning to the subject of the money, can you describe how much money has been spent on this effort so far and where the $30,000 estimated revenue or estimated loss is going to be made up with an OSP? Are you prepared to address that?
I can answer that question, I believe.
Okay.
For the record, my name is Colin Nealon. I am the budget manager for the Department of State Police. Chair Krieger, Vice Chair Hicks, members of the committee, in response to your question regarding the amount of potential money that has been lost due to where we're at as far as compliance with the act at the federal level, there have really been two grant programs that have been offered through the U.S. Department of Justice. One has been referred to as the NCHIP program. It's been a grant program that's been out there for a longer period of time. And it is the one that has approximately about a 10% match associated with it. And that is the one we were looking at. Our most recent grant from the NCHIP was about $300,000. And looking at that match requirement, if we had been able to meet that 90% requirement, then we would have potentially not been subject to that match. And that's where that $30,000 comes from. However, it's important to note that there have been a lot of similarities as far as what sort of activities are allowable under both the NCHIP and under the NARIP grant programs offered by the U.S. Department of Justice. And because of that, the Department of State Police, who has primarily been the recipient of these grant funds, has pursued the NARIP funds more because there has not been a match requirement associated with them. We have received, or in the process of receiving, our third installment awarded from the U.S. Department of Justice related to the NARIP grant. And I'll get back to you exactly on how much, as far as funding goes, have we spent to date, as well as total funds available that we expect to spend. So I'll get that information to you. We'll also provide it by agency, because the money is awarded directly to the Department of State Police, but we have also been passing through funds to the Psychiatric Security Review Board, as well as to the Judicial Department. So we'll definitely get that information forward to you, but I don't have that information with me today. And really getting to the point where we're providing the information both to Representative Juan and to your questions as far as how much has potentially been lost. Strictly speaking, the $30,000 would be purely looking at the NCHIP grant, but when we really get into the reality of it, there really probably has been very little, if any at all, because of the comparison or because of the ability to pursue the NARIP grant funds in lieu of NCHIP grant funds. So we wanted to be completely above board and make sure that, strictly speaking, roughly $30,000 if you were looking at NCHIP funds, but in all reality it's probably closer to zero because of the fact that we've been successful in getting NARIP funds, which are we've been able to use for substantially the same kind of activities.
Okay. Representative Juan, do you have any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So on the NARIP funds, didn't we get our first round of that in 2009?
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Representative Juan, yes, we did. But there were some complications related to that grant. So to bring everyone up to speed, the Department of State Police, the State of Oregon, received our first award under the NARIP grant back in around the fall of 2009. It was after the U.S. Department of Justice had notified the State Police, myself, that we had received that grant, that the Department of State Police went back to the U.S. Department of Justice, and we flagged for them that there was an item within the grant and within the act that we needed some clarification on before we could spend the grant funds. And what that item was is there is some language in the federal act that states that no less than 3%, but no more than 10% of the grant funds can be spent on maintenance of the relief program. And the relief program simply stated has been funding that the State of Oregon has been implementing at the Psychiatric Security Review Board, where folks that were deemed to not be allowed to possess a firearm, that if they had that that designation made, that they could go and appeal that to the Psychiatric Security Review Board then. And so that is the relief piece. The Department of State Police was having ongoing conversations with the U.S. Department of Justice during the application process, and we were letting them know that we did not currently have a relief program in place, and so we were looking to use the grant funds to not only maintain the program, but to start it up. But upon actually receiving the grant, I wanted to get some clarification, because that was definitely a big issue within the grant upon being able to spend those funds. When I sought clarification in writing from the U.S. Department of Justice that we would be okay and that would be an allowable activity to spend those grant funds on, the response we received at that time was more likely than not, no. So because of that, I made the decision and I advised the executive management at State Police that we should not move forward on spending those grant funds until we were able to make sure that we actually had a relief program in place because of that no less than 3% piece in the act.
A couple follow-ups.
There's one.
So when did you find out that you couldn't use the grant funds for the purpose that you wanted to use them for?
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, we found that out in fall of 2009.
Okay. So, and then when did you actually start the process that you're in the middle of now?
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, once we found that out, we worked with the legislature and the governor's office to reach a solution for that. That solution was achieved through House Bill 5100 during the February 2010 special session, where some additional general fund was provided to the Psychiatric Security Review Board to get their program up and off the ground so that we could maintain it. At that point, once we had that, we then moved forward with the U.S. Department of Justice to start implementing the grant, began hiring the people, and we really began the program in earnest more around June of 2010.
One last question, please. My information indicates that we've received approximately $4 million in NAREP grants since fiscal year 2009. You've just told me you started in June of 2010. My thought process and the way I view the world is that this ought to be done. And so I'm very concerned that now we're getting reports that it's not done and that a bulk of records are going to be sent in January of 2012, when it seems to me that with $4 million, this could have been done a lot sooner. This is a very important issue. It is a fundamental civil liberty and involves protection of the public. I really, really, really would like to see this thing get done. Thank you.
Yeah, let me ask Colin one question. Thank you, Colin. On the subject of the grant, do you happen to know, since you're familiar with it, whether the grant includes, contemplates requirements regarding the PSRB relief system? Do you know whether it outlines what that's supposed to look like, whether there's any kind of compliance that the state is supposed to satisfy regarding the PSRB portion of the grant? Do you happen to know that? Or I know you're not the PSRB guy, but I mean, familiar with the grant, I'm asking you.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Representative Hicks. I'm not familiar with that particular point, okay. So we'll get back to you on that. The only piece that I'm familiar with at this point is that there's that particular piece in the Act itself, so it actually is even at a higher level than the grant regarding that no less than 3% but no more than 10% of the grant can be spent on the maintenance of the program. Okay. So there's definitely a piece of the grant that states per the Act that a portion of the grant must be spent on maintaining a relief program.
Okay.
Okay, Major, do you have anything to finish up with us, or?
No, sir, I don't.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
And keep us informed, please.
Yes, we will.
We'll close that informational hearing on that subject, and we're going to go to the reciprocity work group. Mr. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm sure a lot of you remember this issue from last session, and the issue is basically under what circumstances should Oregon recognize a concealed handgun permit from another state. You asked to have a work group. You participated in a couple of meetings, so did Representative Barker and Senator Brzezinski. In addition to that, we had Sheriff Jason Myers, Greg Miller, Rod Harder, and Major Lujan, who are all in the room. Basically, what we talked about was some basic principles. One, if we recognize the concealed handgun permit from another state, they ought to recognize ours. Two, that we should be able to, they should be substantially similar to the requirements that Oregon has, and they're set forth in 137.225, and I can go through them if anyone would like me to do so. We should be able to verify that the person has a valid license and there's a system that's being developed and more states are joining all the time. And also that there should be an affirmative defense. Where this is going to, situation is going to arise, someone's going to drive into the state and they're not going to necessarily go and show that they have a concealed handgun permit. For some reason they're going to get stopped, maybe for speeding. Somehow it comes to the police officer's attention that they have a concealed weapon. And they may have the permit with them, they may not, and it would be an affirmative defense if they didn't, to go into court and show that they had a valid permit from a state that gave reciprocity to ours and had substantially similar requirements. This bill, this 2415, is a bill that we looked at. It was a bill that came out of Rules Committee last year, did not have a hearing, and I think the reason for that, it was in House Judiciary Committee, is there was a similar bill up the year before in 2009, and it got hit with a very large fiscal. And one of the reasons it was, when I went through the fiscal and talked to the LFO, was, well, for some reason, there was a feeling that we had to check every ordinance in the country. What we clarified, and I'm clarifying here now, too, for any legislative history purposes, that basically would it be asking the state police to take our statute and compare the statutes to other states. It's not an ordinance. I don't even know how many
local governments are all with ordinances throughout the United States, and that would be an extremely onerous and expensive task. You have in your material what I got when we started this process from NCSL. They were very nice to supply us with a list of all the different state statutes out there. I also have in here, we went out and copied 33 of the 35 that we have, and I can provide them to anyone electronically if they'd like. And basically, we'd be calling for either in statute or by delegation to the state police that someone do that. I mean, this is going to be a black and white comparison. And one of the terms that we bantered about was substantially similar. We didn't want to use the term similar because someone could argue, well, you didn't have the comma on the right place. And substantially similar means that as it relates to those important points, that they have those similar provisions. For example, that you have a mental health check, they've passed that. The state requires people, they only give licenses if you don't have a mental health issue, you don't have a criminal record, that you have met certain qualifications in the sense of training, that you'd be over the age of 21. That's basically it. As I said, they're all in the audience, and sure, if you'd like, we can come up and testify as to what we went through. And I think it was a successful endeavor, and we cleared up some ambiguities and some question marks.
Well, I haven't been able to talk to Representative Barker on his perception of where they were with the bill, nor have I seen any draft other than the original 2415 to see where Senator Probansky, how closely he's followed that. But I would like to have a couple of people from the gun lobby come up and comment of what they saw. You were in the work group, Rod, and want to come up, Kevin? Would you like to come up?
Kevin was not involved.
Yeah. Both of you. He wasn't in the work group, but I know he's been keeping track of it, and I want to know whether or not there is anything else that you're concerned about or that we need to address between now and the time we have possibly have that bill in legislation.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rod Harder. I was a member of the work group, and not surprisingly, I have a few more problems with it than some of the other folks that took part. Substantially similar bothers me, and I have brought this up. Most of these items should not be a surprise to anyone that was in the group because we've discussed them a couple of times. I have problems with substantially similar. I have problems with the state police being given the authority to develop administrative rules. Now, if you go through 2515, in just about every paragraph, it says someone who has has a license that the state police have determined by administrative rule is similar to ours. When we did preemption, we decided that no agency could do that on their own. We have, or you have, the authority to give the agency the ability to do this by administrative rule, in which case we lose control when it goes to the rulemaking process. So far I've not seen a draft, so NRA's position right now is very open. We don't know what we're going to do until we see what the bill actually does. My opinion is that there will be a very, very limited number of states who will actually benefit from this. Not only do they have to meet our requirement, they also have to give us reciprocity. So I have not seen what I can't quantify what that number will be because we don't have all the details of the bill down yet. The other thing that we have not seen is the fiscal. If we only have six states and we have the fiscal that we were going to apply, or you would get if we did the same thing with 20 states, I think that makes a significant difference. So I'd like to see a fiscal on this before we take a position. And last but not least, it has a clause relating to firearms. And everybody remembers last session. Thank you.
Members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Starr at Oregon Firearms. I was not invited to the work group, so I'm commenting based on what I've heard secondhand, but I have a couple of concerns. As Mr. Harder said, I don't know why we would turn this authority over to the state police because they're an enforcement body and not a judicial body. And as you know, in the past, from 1989 until the mid-90s, The state police had the authority to recognize other states' licenses if they thought they were substantially similar. And when I moved here in 91, I had a pistol license from New York City, which was unheard of. And they wouldn't accept that. In fact, the state police accepted exactly no licenses. I don't know what's changed that would lead us to believe that they'd have a different position and would start accepting licenses now. And the other thing I'd like to throw out in this conversation is that for as long as this conversation's been going on, we've had this the point has been, are these other states as good as we are? Should we recognize a license from another state if they don't meet our lofty requirements? And what I think is I think we're asking the wrong question. I think what we should be asking is, are there states that are issuing licenses to people who then go do something bad? Does the fact that Washington doesn't have the same training requirements we have mean that Washington State is issuing licenses to people who then behave badly and we can't trust the value of their issuing authority? And to be honest with you, my organization did research into all the states and their requirements. Delaware, for example, does not allow you to apply for a concealed handgun license unless you put an ad in the paper saying that's your intention to do it. And I think that what we should be saying is, have there been states where the license holders have, because of their requirements, been engaged in criminal activity? And I know of no statistic that indicates that a single state has any history of, yeah, bad people get licenses everywhere, but does one state stand out? And I know of nothing like that, and I think that's what we should be looking at, is what difference does training actually make? Because in my estimation, you know, as police officers, you know that there were police officers who did dumb things. The issue is not how much training you got, the issue is how much judgment you have. And I don't know that any issuing authority really can determine that.
Those dumb things were only in the traffic division.
I'm sorry?
Those dumb things only happened in the traffic division.
That were the problem.
This has been on. You may not all understand what we're doing here.
Really?
Not wildlife.
Some of us understand too well.
Okay, Kevin, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. My name is Greg Miller. I represent the Oregon Gun Owners. Would like to first thank Mr. Taylor for his efforts in leading this group, as well as Representative Krieger, Representative Barker, and Senator Przanski in their work as well. Two other folks I'd like to thank also are the Sheriff's Association and the State Police for participating in the work group. I feel like it's been a very solid exercise in getting everybody in the room to kick around some of the ideas and issues that came out of last session. Where we're at, I think, is with a concept that has the potential to do good things for Oregon. Again, like Mr. Harder and Mr. Starrett said, not having a bill to look at makes it hard to say, you know, yay or nay on the bill. But I feel strongly that the sheriffs and the state police have been acting in good faith in their willingness to look at the other state statutes and put together a list or a matrix, if you will, of states that have reciprocity statutes that would substantially similar would fall into the category of substantially similar with the Oregon statute. So, thank you everybody for your help. I've been happy to participate in the work group and look forward to seeing what the bill draft looks like.
Okay, the one thing I wanted to comment on was the fiscal that we had from a couple years ago or 4 years ago, whatever it was, because we were very upset with it. I did talk to the superintendent about what happened, and Mr. Taylor explained that, you know, every municipality, everybody else was going to be checked. That was never our intent. But I did have staff spend about 3 hours, and I think we did 18 states in 3 hours. So I think a good person on a computer one day could actually get the information about all the qualifications, make a matrix on it. It isn't that big of a chore. If they can't do it, I'll do it. So thank you for your time. I want Jason, Sheriff Myers, to come up, please. Okay. Major, do you want to come up on this issue too, or just listen to it for now? We'll call you if we need you then. All right, thank you.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my name for the record is Jason Myers. I'm a Marion County Sheriff, and here we're today representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. And you heard from the other folks that have talked. This work group has been working diligently on this task, and the Sheriff's Association is very supportive of reciprocity. Some of the concepts that we've talked about, I believe, are workable, and so we'll be interested to see what this draft legislation looks like, and we'll continue to help effort it.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but maybe I will to a point. I think in some research where there are 9,000 administrative rules in the last biennium through that were instituted by state agencies. And they have the force of law. And as you've heard, we as legislators, you know, whether it be in the Department of Forestry, Ag, no matter where it is, LCDC, DQ, Division of State Lands, we shake our heads because so often what comes out in administrative rule would never get through this committee. It would be stopped, and we'd understand that there were consequences. But the boards and commissions that pass those don't scrutinize them, I don't think, with the same eye that we do through their effect on our constituents. So I just wanted you to know that, you know, as far as some of this being an administrative rule, I don't think during my watch. Anyone else have a question or comment? Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to skip the next one. I'm going to hand the gavel over to Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will open up the informational hearing on enforcing the ban on the sale of tobacco to minors and ask if Judy Cushing here. Oh, good. Chuck Tallman, is Chuck here? And Tom Irwin from OLCC? Guess not. Okay, colleagues, I'm going to just talk a little bit about a possible piece of legislation that I... Oh, great. Could you come on up? Come on up. That would be great. Good. There's been some publicity in the last few months about, even though we have laws prohibiting tobacco sales to persons under 18, that it's not being adequately enforced. And so we are in danger of losing substance prevention and treatment block grants if the rate of sales gets more than 20%. So we're going to hear from these folks about the possibility of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission that now does sting operations on alcohol sales to minors, the possibility of looking into them taking over this concept as well. But in order to do that, we would need to make some legislative changes. But could you first tell us about this issue? Thank you, Judy, for coming.
Thank you. Do I say Interim Chair Tomei and Vice Chair and members of the committee? My name is Judy Cushing, and I'm President and CEO of Oregon Partnership, a statewide prevention and crisis intervention nonprofit here in Oregon. I'm here today to talk with you in support of a concept, of the concept that Representative Tomei just mentioned, of having the OLCC help with the enforcement of underage tobacco use. Despite the good efforts of many state entities and local authorities, there are still approximately 38,000 underage tobacco users here in Oregon. You may or may not know that the federal agency called the Center for Substance Abuse Prevention provides a block grant to the state of Oregon and has for a number of years that amounts to about $15 million that provides much-needed prevention resources to combat tobacco, alcohol, and drug use among young people. But as part of that federal grant, we must comply with something called the SINAR Amendment, which to reduce underage tobacco use. And that SINAR legislation requires states to enact laws prohibiting the sale and distribution of tobacco products to minors, to enforce the laws in a manner that can be reasonably expected to reduce the availability of tobacco to underage youth under the age of 18, to conduct randomized and unannounced inspections of tobacco outlets, and to report these findings to the Secretary of Health and Human Services. We are very close to being out of compliance with a few of those SINAR requirements. One of them is that presently between 16 and 17% of our young Oregonians below the age of 18 are in fact using tobacco, according to the Healthy Teens survey. If we do not comply, we are facing this shortly, the loss of about 40% of that $15 million block grant, which is amounts to $7 million, at a time our state can ill afford to lose those kinds of resources. You may or may not know that Oregon really allocates very, very few dollars to prevention, and we end up paying on the other end, and we just must not lose the federal prevention dollars that we hold precious. I hope you will consider the concept of having the Oregon Liquor Control Commission help with enforcement of underage tobacco use. They already are required to do so on underage alcohol use. This is done in other states, and I hope you'll consider the recommendation.
Thank you, Judy. Questions of Judy? Thank you very much.
I do have testimony. Representative told me I should probably have passed that out.
That would be great. Give it to this lady over here.
I apologize.
No problem. Just go back there. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and co-vice chair and Representative Tomei and members of the committee. My name is Chuck Tauman. I'm a lawyer in Portland, and I'm here today as president of the Tobacco-Free Coalition of Oregon, which is a statewide anti-tobacco advocacy organization that encompasses the major health advocacy groups in the state, the American Heart Association, the American Lung Association, the American Cancer Society, Northwest Health Foundation, and many other advocacy organizations. I've handed out a handout. I don't usually delegate my authority to inform the, or at least my privilege to inform the committee to newspaper reporters, but the article, which was a front page article from the Portland Tribune, is extremely comprehensive. That has all of the facts of the situation as it exists on the ground, and so I commend that to you. But I'm here to help define the problem of underage access to tobacco products. Researchers who have studied youth access recommend a number of key elements to any successful program for avoiding youth access. Of course, the first is the law against it, and as you all know, we have a law in the state of Oregon, as in all other states, that you must be at least 18 years of age in order to purchase and possess tobacco products. The problem is enforcement. The first element is designating a single agency with clear responsibility for enforcement and oversight of the state tobacco access control program. The second is providing adequate and guaranteed funding for that enforcement. The third is disposition of meaningful penalties for violations. The fourth is no preemption of local ordinances. The fifth is implementation of a comprehensive merchant and community education campaign. The sixth is a comprehensive state youth tobacco access control law, including licensure with a graduated fine structure and a license revocation for violations, for repeated violations. And the last that we've all faced before, the most effective way of keeping youth away from tobacco products is increasing the prices. Oregon falls behind in every single component of the comprehensive program. Oregon is ranked as one of the least effective states in the nation for enforcing the ban on sale of tobacco to minors. Oregon's reduction in youth smoking has stalled at 16% of youth, the smoking rate over the last decade. Failing to enforce the minimum age laws not only wastes a constructive opportunity to reduce youth smoking, but it also sends a message to both children and to retailers that it's okay, that this is not important to the state of Oregon, that we keep tobacco products out of the hands of our children. In 2009, nearly one in five attempts to purchase tobacco products by underage children were successful. Currently, 21.1% of high school students are smokers at the time that they leave high school, and roughly one-third of these smokers, one-third of these children, will eventually die prematurely from smoking-related diseases. Recently, the commissioner of the Federal Food and Drug Administration said that it should worry every parent that 20% of U.S. high school students smoke cigarettes. The federal government is committed to preventing children from smoking. For many young adults, that first cigarette or use of smokeless tobacco will lead to a lifetime of addiction, and for many, very serious disease and death. More than 80% of adult smokers began smoking before they reached the age of 18. Retailers are vital partners in the FDA's effort to prevent tobacco use among kids, and we must have an effective way of enforcing the laws that are already on the books. We're not talking about new laws, new prohibitions. We're talking about effective ways of enforcing them. So that's the scope of the problem, and we have the solution at hand. And all we need now is the will to put the solution to the problem and solve this epidemic. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming today. I would direct you to page 4 of the first handout that he gave us that shows that Oregon, along with Maryland, has the highest frequency sales of tobacco to underage kids at 17%. Delaware is the least frequent sales at 2%, so it can be done. I just think it's unacceptable. So thank you so much for coming today, Tom.
Sure.
Do introduce yourself, please.
You bet. Chair Krieger, Vice Chair Hicks, Representative Tomei, members of the committee. I'm Tom Irwin. I'm the Government Affairs and Communications Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. My testimony is going to be fairly brief. We were approached by other sister agencies about this problem, just to have a conversation, if you will, about what's currently going on in terms of enforcement of underage smoking and what we do currently in terms of trying to reduce underage drinking with our minor decoy operations. And then we also had some conversations with Representative Tomei and some other legislators about this. So. But I don't want the legislators to think that we're seeking this to add to our duties. This is something that's a public policy question that you all have to help decide. Currently, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission conducts 1,800 to 2,000 minor sales compliance checks per year on our existing licensees. Over the last 10 years, these checks have been conducted, and the compliance trend has been averaging upward about 0.8% per year. Currently, the compliance rate is around 78%. So those people, 78%, in other words, are not selling to minors of the minor decoy operations that we have going on. Nationally, about 16 states use their alcohol control boards to also enforce tobacco laws. Should the legislators think that this is a good fit, we do need statutory authority, because currently, Oregon Liquor Control Commission could not conduct these without statutory changes. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Yes, Representative.
I have a question. Thank you, Madam Interim Co-Chair. For any of you, but maybe for Tim, so my understanding is that we do not license retailers of tobacco sales currently. Is that correct?
That's correct?
And if we did, we'd have more knowledge of where tobacco is sold. Presumably that would allow us to design and strategies to try to lower the use. So is that that was number six out of your seven recommendations. So I wanted to ask just a little bit more about those strategies, because you listed them quickly, as well as the last strategy, which you put the most emphasis on in terms of raising the cost as a disincentive for teens starting to smoke tobacco. We'd just like to hear a little bit about that, and at what level, how much do you have to raise it by to get them to stop smoking? So if you could address both of those issues, appreciate it.
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chair and co-chairs, and Representative Kenny Geyer. First of all, welcome.
Thank you.
The first question about retail licensure, it is correct that Oregon does not provide for licensing the retailers who sell our most deadly product. We do license other retailers. Certainly the liquor retailers are licensed, but for a variety of reasons, and there has been a bill from time to time before this legislature to license tobacco retailers, the legislature has chosen not to do that. In terms of its relationship to enforcement, there are a couple of ways. One is, as you point out, it allows us to know who's selling, who are the targets of enforcement, who are the people that are selling tobacco to their customers, and unfortunately in 20% of the cases to our children. The second thing is it provides...
I'm sorry, before you go on, so presumably that would enhance the efficiency of your sting operations.
Yes, absolutely, and allow us to know the location, especially relative to, for instance, schools. How many are there within 100 feet or 1,000 feet of a school, which is ties into this exact subject of enforcing the youth access laws. Secondly, it provides an enforcement mechanism, because once you license someone, you're giving state permission to sell a product, you can take that permission away or suspend it. And this is a very, very effective way of enforcement, as Mr. Irwin mentioned from the liquor point of view. In terms of the other aspect of raising the price, this is probably not the time and place to talk about it. This is also something that's been before the legislature many times annually, and that is an increase in the tobacco tax. This is not the platform to talk about that, but the effect of that is that the price of cigarettes are raised. There's a rule of thumb in tobacco control that you must raise the price of the retail price of a pack of cigarettes by at least 10% in order to have a downward effect on consumption. And of course, that's the goal, is to have people buy and smoke fewer cigarettes. Depending on the retail price, that usually means about a 50-cent increase in the tobacco tax. And the important thing is, some of you may have read that the cigarette companies recently increased the price of cigarettes on their own. This was a response to the market. After all, they're selling a product that people have to buy. These are not discretionary purchases. They're made out of discretionary income, but they aren't discretionary purposes. The majority of smokers, in fact, the vast majority of smokers, are addicted to this product. They are products that they have to buy no matter what the price is. The fact is that price has less of a downward effect on this product than on the average product, than on hand soap or clothes or things like that, because of this addiction factor. But it does have a downward effect, and especially with children, so that it is estimated that a 10% increase in the price, in the retail price of cigarettes, results in approximately a 7% decrease in consumption. Ironically, the state still makes money, because if you do the math, if you increase the price by 10%, and you only have a 7% decrease in consumption, the state still makes money by a tobacco tax, and they've done so every year and every time it's been increased.
Well, I just want to thank you. I want to say, first, as a public health advocate, I know that tobacco is the leading cause of preventable death in Oregon. So as a member of the healthcare committee, I'm very concerned about how we can curtail our costs in healthcare. And secondly, as a parent, I was the PTA chair of our elementary school, which was right next to our local high school, across the street from a deli that was selling cigarettes. We kept trying to get them to stop, because not only were the high school students buying it, but the elementary school students were looking up to the high school students. Eventually, we were able to shut that deli down, because they were also selling meth ingredients, and the federal drug czar came and shut it down. We turned it into a local community-owned coffee house. So it's really hard for communities one by one to try to deal with this issue. I really applaud your efforts. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for your questions, Representative, and thank you for sitting in on our committee today. Mr. Chair.
A couple of observations. I was looking in the page 4, Kentucky, 3%. I would probably guess, I hate to think what percentage of tobacco is grown in Kentucky. They're probably growing their own and not buying it. Same with Louisiana, French Quarter and minorities use it at a higher rate. And then I see where Multnomah County is at 24%. And what would the rest of Oregon be without Multnomah County, the basic metro area, which they always affect all of Oregon. They also have the highest number of gangs and gang-related violence, and also the highest percentage of shootings per capita in the state of Oregon. So it seems like it is the metro area that's got some real serious problems. Now, when we had the hearing, and Representative Tomei, you were there last year on medical marijuana. One of the things came out that we saw that Oregon had the second highest of frequency of use of eighth graders and under of marijuana.
Yes.
I don't want to. Do we want to have them smoke marijuana or cigarettes? I don't want to smoke them, probably either one.
That's right.
But I don't want to also increase prices to where it might be as cheap to get cheap marijuana as it is to buy cigarettes. So this is a lot more complex. I don't know if you have a way of getting us the statewide average, excluding Clackamas, Washington, and Multnomah. I'd like to know that.
Well, we could, Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. We can certainly inquire of the Oregon Health Authority, which has current authority for enforcement, to try to tease out those numbers and get those back to you.
I'd like to have them.
Mr. Chair, as you do that, and I'm certainly concerned about the Multnomah County average in here. That's my home county. I also would want to understand about the methodology, though. Are we able to have statistically significant tests in some of the other parts of the state to feed into this? Because it's pretty easy in Multnomah County to do a test and a sting because of the density of the facilities and the outlets. It's pretty hard to do a statistically significant and legitimate test in some areas where the minute someone does one sting, everybody knows who it is who's doing the sting, so they're all on their best behavior. So I'd like to make sure that it is truly a fair comparison, but that doesn't mean that I don't want to put a lot of emphasis into Multnomah County and protecting the kids in that county.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Lund.
Thank you, Interim Chair. So what I'm going to be looking at this, I'm not reflexively in favor or opposed to the OLCC being the agency that handles this. But what's going to be very interesting to me is for you guys to let me know why it is that the OLCC would be more successful than what we're doing or not doing, as the case may be right now. So that's the level of analysis that I'd really like to see. I mean, why are we falling down now? How are you going to do it better? What's the likely result? Thank you.
I want to make it clear, OLCC is not offering to take this.
No, they're not.
We are just talking with them, since they already do some enforcement. Is this something that would maybe gel with what it is that they're already doing?
So thank you.
They are not advocating to take on another job. Believe me.
We will do whatever you ask.
Thank you. Any other questions?
I'll try.
Any other questions? Thank you all so much for coming today and testifying and working on this issue.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for letting me do this.
You have to go. You can write.
Keep on going.
You can close this out.
Okay, what are we talking about? Sexing? You're going to let me do thanks a lot. So we will open
Mr. Taylor will help you with that.
An informational hearing on sexting, displaying sexually explicit material of minors.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is an issue that was before the Senate last year. It was two bills before the Senate. Senate Bill 677 and 678. 678 moved out of Senate Judiciary to Rules Committee, where it stayed. This is a national phenomenon. When I grew up, they didn't even have photocopy machines. Now they have cell phones that can take pictures of intimate body parts and be sent all around the world in a matter of minutes. In 1983, we passed a law, 163-670, which made it a felony to display sexual images of minors. What we now have are minors taking pictures and sending them to their friends many times. And as a result of the Initiative 73, since they don't send it to just one friend at one time, they're now eligible for 25 years in prison. It doesn't mean that they're getting 25 years. It doesn't mean that there's a rash of prosecutions in this area. There are some, historically, and I can't tell you whether it's for sexting or more serious issues. I have a memo which we supplied to, and with that memo is another memo from NCSL, plus what other states are doing in this area. And I think one of the things that the Legis Brief and NCSL talks about, advocates for change in the law say they are necessary because some prosecutors feel they have only two options, charging the juvenile with a crime that have overly harsh penalties or entering no charge at all. What the bills from last session would have done would have carved out a new offense, made it a misdemeanor, where this matter could have been held, taken care of in juvenile court. The difference between the two bills came down to this. 678 gave judges discretion as it relates to a picture of a kid under 12. 677 did not. The difficulty you face in these bills is trying to write a bill that covers every factual situation. And let me give you an example. What happens if the kid under 12 sends a picture to a kid who's 15, who turns around and sends it to a bunch of friends? I would hope that the DA doesn't prosecute. One would hope that's taken care of in juvenile court. But at the same time, what happens if the 15-year-old is running a porn site for kids under 12? I mean, that's the difficulty we face. And both bills did try to distinguish out the situation where the person was running a porn site or was using the pictures for extortion. Gail Meyer is put together a pretty good memo that she sent to me, and I don't know if it's in final form. But the numbers they talk about this have gone up even from when I looked at it, and we're now talking that probably 39 to 45% of the kids are doing this. That's a large percentage. A very large percentage. The kid's in juvenile court, the judge can say, give me a cell phone. Then he can say to the parents, you give him another cell phone, I'm holding you in contempt. So they've got a lot of broad discretion to probably handle this. You've heard a lot about the brain science in kids. It's even made the front page of the National Geographic, the New Science in Teenage Brains, which basically says what any parent with teenagers knows, that they're a little bit exuberant at that age. And they don't necessarily think about consequences. I can't remember back to when I was there, but what can I say? This is probably an issue that we'll take up in a work group, not for 2012, but after the 2012 session for 2013. And I have to admit, the language we put together, 677 and 678, was probably a little bit clunky. We did it just before the last session. We did it quickly. And I think that, as the NCSL memo mentioned, is that there's probably a need for an alternative in between nothing and 25 years. Yes.
Yes. Madam Chair.
Yes.
The alternative is education. We need to help teach kids a bit more concept of what the impacts are and a bit more self-respect.
I think it's not just kids, I'm thinking of someone in, wasn't it New York State, who did
yes,
some
indeed.
Sexing, an adult male.
Oh, yes. Madam Chair, if I could add something to it, it's not a crime in this state for even a kid to send a picture of a nude adult to another kid, which is different than other states. So that makes it unique. It's when they send a picture of themselves or another kid. And it's there's a 3-year age defense if they have a sexual relationship. There is no 3-year age defense as far as sending a picture.
Interesting. Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As the particulars of the bill, particularly the one that would have I guess, included persons under the age of 12, I mean, that's a carve-out from the juvenile scheme as it is. Was the committee particularly concerned about this crime, whereas a carve-out would be deemed necessary for persons under the age of 12? I mean, that's a real departure from our current approach under the juvenile system.
Representative Hicks, you're right. It was an issue that was discussed probably in work groups more than before the committee. It was a feeling, at least in the Senate Judiciary Committee, would give discretion to judges as it relates to that issue because of the difficulty in dealing with the 12-year-old who sends it to the 15-year-old versus the 15-year-old who's running a porn site. And that's what makes it very difficult in this area.
Yeah, I mean, the state is typically not going to be charging persons under the age of 12. So
no, but the person who's 15. So the 12-year-old sends a picture to the 15-year-old. The 15-year-old turns around and sends it to two other 15-year-olds one day, two other 15-year-olds the next day. He has committed the crime, or she has committed the crime. In fact, probably the majority of these situations are girls, more than guys.
Okay.
And so it's the crime when they send it. Okay?
Yeah.
It's the 12-year-old, you're right. The 12-year-old is under 12, I think is okay. I want
to... Well, that's what I'm trying to clarify, because, I mean, that seems strange, that this was the difference between the two bills, is whether we're going to charge 11-year-olds with...
No, actually, it was the issue of the giving the judge discretion where the picture involved a kid under 12.
Oh, whether the subject
yes,
of the...
I'm sorry, I wasn't clear on that. Yeah.
Oh, no,
I have seen cases of under 12 where they were in juvenile court.
The origin charges. Of the picture is typically the offender, the first offender in the chain is what you're saying. It's typically how it plays out, right?
Madam Chair, Representative Hicks, there's a long chain in this.
Okay.
And not just the first person taking the picture and sending it, which could be the person themselves, is guilty. Anyone who forwards it is potentially liable.
And one more. Under the current registration laws, is it possible to discern whether somebody convicted of felony sexting would have to register as if they are a minor?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, when we had our work groups as it relates to sex offender registration, Ms. Carney, who was in that group, who was here today, mentioned that they've had people as young as 12 on the list.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Nolan.
Thank you. And notwithstanding my comment earlier about education, I also think something for us to be mindful of as we try to sort this out is the potential for ratcheting up and, as Mr. Taylor described, the hammer that this might create over a kid's head for some unrelated offense. All of a sudden, we've got someone who says, well, I can't get you on that other offense, but I'm going to use this offense in order to get you to plea bargain on something else. That would trouble me, that we use something that is sadly commonplace to put some kids in a box that does not help them move effectively into adulthood. So as we think about this and as any work group gets together, I'd hope that we'd be mindful of those implications.
Good point. Is there a work group, Mr. Taylor?
Madam Chair, members of committee, there is not a work group yet. We had one before. I know that, that there probably will be. I know the Senate yesterday expressed a desire to do so.
Good.
I think the big issue here, as always, will be district attorneys and police always have discretion to arrest someone, to bring a charge, and then the issue comes down to how much discretion to a judge. I mean, there are ways of limiting that to the extent of saying, okay, if it's been used for extortion or you're running a porn site, you don't get the discretion. It's when you get into some of these other issues that are under 12 and others that, I mean, that was a sticking point. That McClunky language.
Yes. Okay, with that, unless there are further comments or questions, we will close the informational hearing on sexting and open up an informational discussion on Senate Bill 878 regarding checking identification at the door for nightclubs, taverns, or bars. Mr. Taylor.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there are several people in the back of the room, but I can probably handle this. You probably remember this bill from last session. The issue was whether you should be BPSSD trained or a licensed server, and we passed a bill relating to special events. We also thought, some people thought at that time, that would also cover bars and taverns. The issue here being, should the person at the door be BPSSD trained to check an ID, or could a bartender who can check an ID behind the bar be able to go outside at the door and check the ID there? We've had a work group meeting the other day, and one of the things that we talked about, that it would be okay for a bartender to do that. This is we had the city of Eugene there, the city of Portland. We had the Restaurant Association. We had DPSST there. And what we talked about was that it would be, if it was incidental. So if the person did it occasionally, not on a regular basis. After the work group meeting, the next day I got an email from DPSST saying after we looked at the language and we discussed the fact of being incidental, maybe we don't need a bill. Now, we do have a bill potentially being filed on the Senate side on this issue to clarify the issue. And we will meet afterwards between now and December 5th to make everyone, if that in fact is true, we don't need a bill, to make the restaurant industry and the hospitality industry feel comfortable that if we don't pass a bill, they won't get cited.
Are any of you folks here to talk about this issue? If so, you're welcome to come up, but it sounds like you're just happy to listen. Okay. Any questions, any comments from anyone about this issue? It sounds like it's going to be handled in the Senate, right?
Looks like it.
Okay. Thank you. Any other business in front of the committee with that? Yes, Mr. Taylor.
As of, this committee has 5 bills to file. Right now we have 2. One removes the sunset from House Bill 2207 in 2009. You have the list. That was a bill that allowed the zoo to do background checks.
Oh, right.
And this would remove the sunset provision earlier than it needs to be, but it would be done in time so they don't have to worry about doing it later. And the other one is a bill that represents, it filed House Bill 3662 that relates to volunteer medical providers providing services to veterans, and it relates to the putting them in the same category as other volunteers as it relates to a potential liability issue.
That's it.
Okay.
Two bills?
So far.
So far. Okay.
It drives up the cost.
All right. Any other business? Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, for letting me handle the gavel today. And with that, I close the House Judiciary Committee. Thank you.